Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
What does it mean to be queer?
What is being queer if not questioning everything?
How does the notion of queerness subvert or undermine traditional ideas of gender and sexuality?
Okay, so what, you're into, like, polyamory now?
No, I'm just saying, what if we didn't just have the sort of knee-jerk, heteronormative...
Listen to yourself. You've been queer for, like, 30 seconds.
When queer is used to describe non-normative identities in politics, what does it mean?
Could a rich, white, cisgendered, politically conservative gay man ever call himself queer?
Andrew is also an out and proud homosexual.
He's here, he's queer, and we're used to it.
Is queerness just a marker of sexual orientation, or is it a political and social identity?
Our guest is Susan Stryker, editor of the Transgender Studies Reader.
Queerness. Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
On Monday, October 14th, come join us for a live recording of Philosophy Talk on the campus of San Francisco State University.
We'll be thinking about sanctuary cities with philosopher Shelley Wilcox.
The event is free and open to the public. More information at philosophytalk.org.
That's Monday, October 14th, 4 o'clock at Jack Adams Hall on the SF State campus.
Is queerness something that all lesbian, gay, bi, and trans people have in common?
Or is queer just an empty umbrella term with no real content?
Is queerness a sexual identity, a political identity, or something else?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford. Ken teaches philosophy there, and so do I.
We're all familiar with the term queer, but what does it actually mean?
Well, the word queer used to be a sexual slur.
And some people still hear it that way, but nowadays we also have departments of queer studies in universities, John.
Yeah, Ken, I'm going to admit something to you. I'm not 100% sure what the word queer means in that context.
Well, queer theory has roots in the ideas of Michel Foucault and his thought that sexuality and sexual categories are shaped and constituted by history and culture.
Well, most things are. Is this as opposed to being fully determined by biology and genes?
Exactly, John. Take ancient Greece, for example. Young men in ancient Greece were often encouraged to take older male lovers.
Pedophilia, maybe?
Well, they didn't think of it that way. They didn't think of it as a perversion at all. They thought of it as the highest form of mentorship if it was done right.
Yeah, sure. What's your point?
My point is that guys have been having sex with guys since ancient times and even before that. But the category gay didn't become a thing, didn't become a real thing in sexual politics, culture, and identity formation until very recently, actually.
And what should we conclude from that exactly?
That sexual identities are not determined by biology and not even by sexual behavior. They're more about how people think of themselves.
Biology doesn't do it. Sexual behavior doesn't do it. What does determine sexual identity?
That's a complicated thing, John. I mean, for example, when it comes to queer identity, did you know that some homosexual people don't identify as queer at all, and some non-homosexual people do identify as queer?
Is this kind of like maybe a generational thing? Like young, hip gays and lesbians who live in big cities or go to elite colleges call themselves queer instead of gay or lesbian, while people my age, my gay friends, they just call themselves gay.
Now, John, you said you didn't know anything about this, but you actually stumbled into something true. And the truth you stumbled into is that queer is an identity that is both contested and is in flux.
Well, enlighten me then about the complexity of queerness.
Well, I'm not sure I can enlighten you, but I can tell you this, that for some people, queer is just a shorthand. It's an umbrella term that includes a variety of other identities. Other people reject terms like gay or lesbian completely and prefer to identify as straight-out queer instead. Still, other people actually loathe the term queer. They think of themselves as gay and lesbian, bi, or trans, but they refuse to call themselves queer.
Well, the word just seems like a useless queer linguistic tangle.
What's a queer tangle is human identity. That's the queer tangle.
Well, let's go back to basics and focus on the core linguistic meaning of queer, the word queer. Linguistically speaking, queer implies that something is off, deviant.
Yeah, and which is why it could be used as a slur in the first place. It was used to bully and intimidate people who didn't fit what the culture considered normal or respectable when it comes to sexuality.
But you're saying it doesn't have to be a slur. It can just be used to embrace one's deviance and announce it rather than to reject and stigmatize it.
Exactly. That's like when queer activists first added, "We're here! We're queer! Get used to it!" They were proudly refusing to conform to society's norms.
All right. So now explain to me about trans people. Where do they fit into this sexual linguistic stew?
Well, trans people may or may not identify as queer, and they may or may not identify as gay or lesbian or straight.
I guess that's because being trans is a different dimension of deviation from the norm than being lesbian, gay, or bi. Being trans doesn't necessarily imply anything about who you're attracted to.
Well, right. A trans man might be attracted to women, to men, to both, to neither. You name it.
Well, then, what's the point of including trans people among the queer?
Well, that's complicated too, John.
So, take a trans person who's been assigned by society to one gender category, say woman, but is also attracted to women. What would you call such a person?
Well, I don't know. Lesbian, right? Is that right?
Well, not so fast. Suppose that person decides to transition from female to male. If the person is still attracted to women, do they suddenly become straight?
I don't know. Maybe the person was a straight male all along, just trapped in a woman's body, so we should take account of that, too.
Well, what about the female partner of such a person? Is her sexual identity also changed when her partner transitions from being a lesbian woman to a straight man?
John, you got me. It's beyond my pay grade. I don't know the answer to that one. But you know what I do know? That's a beautiful thing about the term queer. It encompasses potentially the full range of human sexuality in all of its non-binary messiness.
To find out more about that non-binary messiness, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to talk to a couple of people who don't define themselves in terms of any traditional gender roles. She files this report.
I love the term queer. You know, I didn't always.
That's Joanna Ramsey. She's a transgender woman who spent 8 years in a men's prison.
It used to be like a word that I felt was offensive, but then I kind of like learned to embrace it because it means like not the average, not the status quo.
Ramsey says in prison, the word queer was not a good thing. When she was released in September of 2016, she found many in the LGBT community now embrace the term.
I think any time that you're a minority or an oppressed minority, that there needs to be like a fellowship and a camaraderie within your own community. And so I just wish that we could all embrace like some of those terms that, you know, have been used to attack us.
Ramsey says the word queer encompasses an umbrella community for so many people who define themselves as outside the norm.
To embrace that word queer means that you have taken on the mantle of being different and that you've taken on the responsibility of being different, because I think that there's a consequence that comes with that. And you have to be willing to be a stronger person for it. You have to be willing to advocate, to stand up for what's right. And it's hard. It's not the easy route.
I just like the Webster's definition of queer as being different.
Jesalito B. is a Filipino-American choreographer in San Francisco.
That's sort of fundamental to everything I believe is queer, is that it is different. It's not the normative. And that is delightful for me because that's where I live.
B. created a dance theater show in 2016 called Legendary Children. It explores the term queer and how generations of queer people paved the way for today's LGBT communities.
It is because he fought and sweat and bled and marched and rallied and stood up so that the world that you live in is better than the world that he grew up in.
B says his inspiration for the play was the 1999 song by Holly Johnson called Legendary Children.
Add your name.
I'll self-identify as being gay, but queer is actually closer to who I am. It's so much more than who I sleep with. It's about how I interface with the world, you know, ideologically, how this disrupts things that are, you know, heteronormative or normative. That's a lot of what queer is. It's about this disruption of the status quo. You know, and if you're talking about sexuality or politically or ideologically, that pretty much encapsulates what I define as queer.
Not everyone loves the term queer. The president of the National Gay Newspaper Guild wrote in 2016 that turning a once derogatory term on its head only hurts LGBT seniors who have a painful history with the word. But Jesselito B., the SF choreographer, says even though queer used to be derogatory, by reclaiming the word, LGBT communities are defanging those who have oppressed them in the past and those who are trying to do so in the present. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Shuka, thank you for helping us understand the linguistic and sexual messiness of the 21st century. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today we're thinking about queerness. We're joined now by Susan Stryker. She's a professor of gender and women's studies at the University of Arizona. She's former director of the Institute for LGBT Studies and editor of TSQ, the Transgender Studies Quarterly. Susan, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
So, Susan, how did you first become interested as an academic subject in questions about gender and sexuality?
Well, it's personal for me. It's like I am a transgender person and had transgender feelings from earliest childhood. So there was a curiosity for me about, like, how does somebody like me even exist? And it did become a focus of my academic work later in life to understand the historical dimensions of how identities are formed.
So in our little intro, Ken and I struggled to come up with a neat definition of queerness. I think it's fair to say we failed. Maybe it's a term that defies neat categorization. Can you help us understand what queer means?
Well, I noticed that you kept using the word deviance, you know, when you talked about queer, that queer is about a kind of deviance. And, you know, many people would think of deviance as having kind of a pejorative, you know, cast to it in and of itself. But I think if you take the word queer back, not just to its English usages, but like back to the Indo-European, you know, roots of words that inform.
I'll let you take it.
Okay,
back.
I will. I'm the historian, yeah, so okay. Right, you leave that one to me. It's like in the roots of the word queer. It's like you see it show up in Latin words like torcere, like to turn or to twist, like torque, or even in the Anglo-Saxon word athwart, meaning to cross over. So queerness just means like a kind of turning and twisting and crossing and departing from a straight line. So it's like there's a kind of conceptual richness to the word queer, quite apart from the way it's become historically connected to sexuality.
So it sounds to me like look, there was this history of the word queer as a in English. I don't know if there are similar terms in other languages that would translate our term queer in the same way as a derogatory term for homosexuality. It sounds to me like you're saying, and there's this reclamation that's happened where it's taking it back to its original roots, and that's a good thing. But I mean, why? I hate the N-word, and I hate it that rappers are trying to reclaim that word. I just despise that movement. I mean, so how does that happen? I mean, why is that a good thing? I'm kind of with the old folks, I guess. Right?
Well, you are pretty old, Kate.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think historically, I mean, part of what feels liberatory about being queer is you know, so much negativity and hostility gets pointed at one as a queer or trans person, and that I think the particular political brilliance of the sort of liberation movement is to take those negative feelings and like transform them into something that's actually quite beautiful. It's like, I think the N-word is harder to reclaim, but like, what's wrong with saying, like, you know what, being different is actually like pretty cool and powerful.
But the N-word now is kind of restricted to African Americans, but as I understand it, the
alphabet soup.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, queer is okay for all of us to use.
Queer studies department.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it does kind of depend, I think, on, you know, who's using it and why. It's like it can still be used as an epithet, and it could still be used in a very affirmative way. So it's not the word itself, it's the speech act and the intention
right.
of the speech
I
act.
I gotcha. I think that's really important. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about queerness, gender identity, and more.
Is queer an umbrella term that encompasses anyone who's sexual or gender identity deviates from dominant culture? Or is there more to queerness than that?
Queerness, gender, and sexuality, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Look at that bunch of cows.
Not bunch, John, herd.
Herd of what?
Herd of cows.
Well, of course I've heard of cows.
No, a cow herd.
Well, what do I care what a cow herd? I've got no secrets from cows.
But it's no secret that Philosophy Talk depends on donations from our listeners to help keep us on the air. So go make your donation at philosophytalk.org now.
And question everything.
Except if you heard it from a cow.
Girls who are boys who like boys to be girls who do, and so forth and so on. Seems like gender and sexuality are a lot more complicated than just those two words. Who would have known? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're thinking about queerness.
Our guest is Susan Stryker from the University of Arizona. She's the editor of TSQ, Transgender Studies Quarterly.
So, Susan, I know that you identify both as queer and as trans. And I want to try and figure out what the relationship between those two identities are. Can you help illuminate the difference between, or the similarities, or whatever, between those two identities?
Well, I don't think they have to go together necessarily. You know, queerness I do think of as kind of a more of a political and aesthetic identity. It doesn't have to be linked to notions of homosexuality at all. I think about historically where the word first started being used in a non-derogatory manner, and it really came out of the AIDS crisis in the 1980s. That you know, you might remember that AIDS was first called GRID, gay related immune deficiency.
Well, actually, I don't remember that.
And
how long did that last?
Not too long. Because, you know, there was a kind of homophobic assumption that this was a gay men's disease. But if you look at who the affected communities were, it's like, yes, gay men, but also hemophiliacs who had received blood transfusions, people engaged in commercial sex work who had a lot of partners, IV drug users, and Haitian immigrants. And that's because the disease itself, the vectors for its transmission are structural vulnerabilities in marginalized populations, right? So what's the word that you use to like bring together all of these disparate communities affected by AIDS? And very early on, a public health activist named Cindy Patton proposed using the word queer, like this was a queer constellation of affected communities.
Oh.
You also saw it being taken up by Gloria Anzaldúa, who was teaching at the University of California, Santa Cruz, who used the word queer to try to get at the complexities of race and gender as well as sexuality.
But why that word? Because in that time, that word was a slur in the wider culture
suggesting earlier about the reclamation of something negative. It's like this negative thing that you were pointing at me, I don't feel negative about at all, and I am turning
I kind of get that, but what puzzles me is, because it's at home slurring territory, was sexual preference, right? Mm-hmm. But this umbrella that you describe includes that, but includes much more. It might have struck me as weird. I don't know. If I were a trans man, I'm not a trans man, I'm just cisgendered, but if I were a trans man who presented to the world as female and was attracted to women because I thought that's what men do and I felt, you know, and somebody called me gay or queer, I feel, wait a minute, no, you're misconstruing me, right?
Yeah, well, so that's why there's a difference between gay and queer. You know, that if you mean gay, meaning a gay male person, I mean, that can be different than queer. And a trans person who has a homosexual sexual orientation may think of themselves as queer. So you know, I don't think it has to be
so
confusing.
What I'm wondering is though, was there any resistance for this umbrella term that somebody decided was going to group all these people together? Was there a resistance on the part of the people?
Sure,
who
Sure, there's a generational difference, or they're like for trans people, like a lot of trans people think of themselves as straight in their desired gender. There are people who think of themselves as gay or lesbian who resist the idea of queer. You know, it's like it's complicated. But you, John, I think it was you who mentioned, like, so what about somebody who was assigned female, who's been a lesbian, who transitions and is a man, and what do you call that person? Mm-hmm. What do you call their partner? Well, why not just queer? Because it's like it's a non-normative, non-standard way of thinking about your body, your identity, your relationships, your desires. So why not just call it queer?
So what we got is a term that had a derogatory use for homosexuals. Then it got acquired another kind of orthogonal use as the oddity of the mixture of people who got AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's been recruited for a third thing, a useful term for people who, I don't know, march to the beat of a different drummer, but you're not sure which drummer it is.
Yeah. You know, I like that you use the word orthogonal. Because, you know, in one of the texts by Michel Foucault, who, you know, was mentioned earlier in the talk today, that what he said was critically, philosophically interesting about the homosexual was not the homosexual per se, but the way that paying attention to homosexuality allowed you to draw diagonal lines of connection through the social fabric, and to see the ways that the social field was sort of orchestrated by all of these often unstated norms and conventions.
So let me ask you a question, kind of in my interest as a philosopher of mind and philosophical psychology and all that stuff, driven by the hearing this Foucault thing, which I kind of like. I'm not quite sure I fully understand it. But how deep do you think this goes into, like, the human psyche? That is, you know, I mean, I conceive of myself as lots of things. I conceive of myself as a male. I conceive of myself as an American. I conceive of myself as a leftist, as a sometimes Democrat. I conceive of myself as a philosopher. Some of them are really deep, and some of them are shallow. Some, you know, I could give up. The Democratic Party has pissed me off so many times that for a while, 10 years, I was an independent. Mm-hmm. Right.
Did I hear a forbidden word?
Yeah. But, okay. So, I mean, so how does this sexual identity fit in the whole, or identity as queer, because it's not just a sexual identity, how does it fit in the whole kit of things by which I...
Well, you know, I'm going to cop out a little bit there and say it's just really different for everybody, I think. I think we make these assumptions that there's some kind of like intrinsic, innate human character or essence. And, you know, I'm a historian, and I think pretty much everything like changes over time according to culture and language. And so it's really hard to pin down those things that seem intrinsic, unchangeable, inescapable versus those things that seem changeable over time. You know, I can only say for me, like wherever it came from, like this really deeply held innate sense of preferring to answer to the pronoun she and resisting being labeled he by the world, it's like is something that is completely inseparable from my sense of who I am. Mm-hmm. That is the thing that doesn't change.
Tell me about pronouns, because we've got an Instagram question. I think this is our first question ever from Instagram from Jay Goling. Says, hope you guys talk about Jordan Peterson and pronouns. I'm not sure who Jordan Peterson is.
I don't know Jordan Peterson either, but I'm happy to talk about pronouns.
Yeah, tell me about pronouns, because this is a hot new thing, or maybe it's not so new. But
well, it's actually not so new. The new thing is that there are trans people or genderqueer people, however, you know, gender non-binary people who are pushing now to have more ways of being referred to in a non-gender binary way. And one of the more common strategies is to use the pronoun they as a singular as well as a plural, which actually has quite a long history in English. It's like it's documented back into like the 11th and 12th centuries. But the quest for new pronouns in English is not new. The first time you see a big political push for it is in the 1790s.
I wish I could bring our producer Devin, who has a PhD in linguistics, in on this, because he's in the other room. Because one of the things I wonder is, does the language faculty, you know, that innate language mm-hmm. faculty that meaning linguists believe is there, is it ready for that? I mean, we can force those pronouns on us as a kind of political act, but a kid acquiring his or her first language, will they naturally learn these things or not? Do you know the answer?
Yeah, well, you know, I know the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is a bit of a, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, it's more complicated than it gets represented in yeah. pop culture, but I do tend to lean towards that sense of how we form our thoughts and actions are really shaped by the specificities of the language that we're using and acquiring, rather than mm-hmm. having that more Chomskyan idea.
Right.
And so, you know, I do think that people have and do take up, you know, many different kinds of linguistic and cultural structures that have a wide variety of ways of dealing with gender and sex reference.
But I think there's something to be said for simplifying linguistic structures. For example, in Black English, they have this very useful word be, which I find tremendously useful in philosophy, because you don't always want tense around. So you mm-hmm. say 2 + 2 = 4, then, you know.
Mm-hmm. Or now, you be the man, John.
Yeah, and a lot of people coming through Stanford, don't come from countries where, or linguistic frameworks where they don't, the he-she mm-hmm. distinction is not at all familiar. And they seem to do just fine. They don't seem to kind of get mixed up in life in any particular way. Why don't we go that direction and simplify?
Well, language is a complicated thing. It doesn't just bend to our wishes. But I want to ask you another thing about, I think our culture is slowly changing. Well, actually, kind of rapidly changing, uh-huh. right? Uh-huh. I'm not sure. I mean, especially with gays and lesbians. I'm not sure about trans people. We're in this middle of this awful, awful thing. But, you know, I saw this movie. I watched Moonlight the last night. And it was such a powerful movie. And I was thinking about why it's so powerful. And I thought, well, because it doesn't, although it tells a story universally applicable, it's like an intimate look at a life. Here is a life. Look at this life. This is a human life. And people look at human lives and they feel sympathy. I mean, most people don't look at human lives and feel revulsion unless they feel sympathy. So how can we get more seeing to happen? That seems to me the key to progress. Sort of yeah. seeing the other.
You know, I think that is always the major ethical challenge. It's like, how do you greet the stranger who presents right. themselves at your door?
Right.
You know, and I don't think there's a one size fits all answer to it. But, you know, I love that you brought up Moonlight, because, you know, that is not a trans film, right? But I think one of the things that I find fascinating about it is that I would call it a very queer film. It's like, because a lot of the characters exceed what our expectations are for the category that we assign
that's
them to,
true.
Right?
Right?
And so you know, that's why I say queerness has an aesthetic dimension. It's
right.
like, it's like that positive valuing of precisely those hard to define, unnameable things that exceed the categories we put people in.
It's like
in.
The drug dealer guy character.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
He's such a mensch in a way, but he's mm-hmm. also a drug dealer.
Yeah.
And he's got guys in the corner and all that, but he is so, I mean, he empowers.
Mm-hmm.
He empowers in through his deep sympathy.
You guys both seem kind of optimistic. You were using the term progress and so forth. I mean, what world are you living in? Don't we see a rejection of all the progress of the Obama years?
And, yeah, well, you know, I see it as a, you know, there were definitely two steps forward during the Obama mm-hmm. years in terms of civil rights and protections for trans people. And under the current administration, I do see a pronounced one step back.
Well,
but
good.
There is a, there, you know, the thing that gives me hope in the long run is that, you know, kids today, you know, to use that cliche, really do understand gender differently than people of my generation and, you know, your generation, that a sea change has happened. And so I think whatever legislative losses or judicial yeah. losses come in the near future, it's like the tide has already turned.
So we've got a question from an emailer on kind of along these lines. From Fanya, Could you please address the issue of feminism versus transgender experience, compatible struggles are in conflict, and the bathroom issue? If gender identity is just internal and not biological, how can one stand up to anti-trans people trying to dictate bathroom use? And what if you're gender neutral? What bathroom can you go to? So Funya has lots of questions.
Okay, well, I'll try to do quick answers. As was mentioned, I edited a journal called TSQ, Transgender Studies Quarterly. We did a special issue in 2016 called Trans Feminisms, which is about the relationship between transgender politics and theorizing and feminist activism. I see them as not incompatible at all. And actually, one of the sort of founding figures of what now gets called intersectional feminism, coming out of Black and Chicano feminist history, a person by the name of Pauli Murray, a very famous legal theorist, is actually a person who had transgender experience. They had looked at transitioning female to male early in their life and decided not to do that. But they brought that trans sensibility into their intersectional understanding of gender, sexuality, and race. Briefly mention another project I'm involved with called Stalled, which is about bathrooms and architecture, mm-hmm. working with a Yale University architect named Joel Sanders and a law professor at the University of Utah named Terry Kogan. And, you know, I think one of the ways that we can solve this bathroom problem is by redesigning public toilets. It really is about equal access right. to public space for all bodies, and there are some architectural solutions that give us an end run.
I'm not exactly an expert on it, but my general impression over the years is that so-called men's bathrooms have urinals and stalls, and women's bathrooms tend to just have stalls. And that makes me wonder, well, what's the problem? I mean, you go into a stall and, you know, if you're a pre-operative male-to-female trans, big deal. I mean, am I missing something?
You're missing the symbolic resistance. I mean, this is all symbolic of where you stand relative to the old and the new, that which is being challenged, that was being transformed, a world being taken away from you. Mm-hmm. And you might think, well, why is your allegiance to that old world so intense? Because it excluded, it oppressed, but you know, that was your world. And when people have their world taken away, they resist.
I think that's true. And it takes some work to say that, you know, that when people hold on to a privilege that they didn't recognize as being a privilege that actually harms other people, that's where the educational work needs to come in.
And that's where the deep sympathy needs to come in and all that. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking about queerness and gender identity in the 21st century with Susan Stryker from the University of Arizona.
Do you think daughters should marry men and sons should marry women? Or do you embrace the non-binary progressive messiness of 21st century America?
Changing attitudes and eliminating bigotry when Philosophy Talk continues.
We hope you're enjoying this week's free stream.
Philosophy Talk is made possible by listeners like you, and we really need your support.
And the more you give, the more you get.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating.
Let's get back to the program. Queer is here to say, how should social norms adapt? I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Susan Stryker from the University of Arizona, and we're thinking about queerness.
Susan, we've arguably made a lot of progress over the last few decades in being open to the varieties of sexual experience and preferences. But there still seems to be a lot of people, some of them in high positions, who have a problem with queer identities, and particularly these days with trans identities. So, I mean, what if you were in charge of the attitudes of the American people, or at least making some initiatives to change them, what would you do?
Well, you know, I I do think one of the most important things to recognize is that there's already legislation on the books that protects against discrimination based on sex and gender. In the past, they have not been interpreted as including transgender people, and part of the sea change in recent years is just simply to recognize that, no, like Title IX does in fact cover discrimination against transgender people. So there's a change in attitude. I do think specific anti-discrimination legislation can be helpful, but, you know, it's only one part of a broader legal strategy. Mm-hmm. The most important thing is changing attitudes. It's like if you change people's attitudes, if you win people's hearts, then it kind of doesn't matter quite so much what the letter of the law is.
I want to try something on you, though, about you said queer is, like, you know, rejecting the standard norms and all that stuff and going beyond and valorizing the rejection of that, the differentness. Well, then why not go more full hog? I'm all in favor of gay marriage, but, you know, I know people who think, I used to know people when I was younger. marriage is like an obsolete bourgeois institution, but why should gays and...
Well, I'm one of those people, too. It's like, you know, like I think marriage is one of the last vestiges we have of like a socially sanctioned notion of property in another person. Mm-hmm. You know, I am a long-term committed partnered, you know, with another person, and we have no desire or intention to get married.
So I'm saying that why is the queer political agenda? So my wife asked me, would a log cabin Republican... I didn't know the answer to this. I was telling her about the show. Would a log cabin Republican identify as queer? I said, I'm not sure, but I guess not, because they probably think the progressive part, that's a Republican, that's a gay Republican.
Right. Yeah.
I said, maybe not, because they might not want to swear allegiance to what they regard as a progressive leftist agenda. But there is an agenda they could get on board with as allies, like gay marriage, equality, blah, blah, blah. Right.
You know, I'm kind of a big tent, popular United Front kind of person in my politics. I mean, my own politics are quite, you know, to the left. But you know, I think that for lasting change to happen, it's like you have to find common ground with people across a larger part of the political spectrum. And so, you know, it's like some gay, lesbian, bi, and trans people are more politically moderate or centrist than I am, but it's just like, that's
so,
all right.
But what I'm trying to figure out is how much accommodation, I don't have a view, and I'm just asking you to enlighten me, how much accommodation can queer as an identity make, as a whatever kind of identity make, with the kind of standing normative structure, and how much, like, blowing up the standard normative structure?
All right, so, you know, I personally, it's like, you know, I'm really interested in alternative cultural spaces, you know, experimental art practices, people who actively experiment with different ways of living, you know, whether that's, you know, collectively or what have you. But however, quote unquote, radical my vision of what society could be is, it's like we live in society as it exists now, and you don't want to be discriminated against or held as being less worthy or valuable or having less access to social benefits and resources than anyone else. So it's like, yes, trans and gay people should be allowed to serve in the military, even if I oppose what the U.S. military often does. Mm-hmm. They should be able to get married, even if I think marriage is not an institution that, you know, I personally endorse. You should not be able to be fired or lose a job.
Right. I get all that.
But in terms of making progress, I mean, I think it's arguable that there was pretty slow progress and considerable and important progress, but only when we got the depiction of gay people and lesbian people on television did things really begin to change rapidly. If you go look at California, the difference between the election in which gay marriage was voted down and the current climate, it's television, isn't it?
Yeah, well, mass media more broadly, you know, before the Caitlyn Jenner moment a couple of years ago, surveys showed that only 8% of the U.S. population knew a trans person. And after that year of massive publicity, the numbers doubled to about 16% of the population, of the adult population, claimed they knew a trans person. So given that, mass media is how 84% 85% of the population gets its information. So, yeah, media representation is totally important.
We've got a caller, Reed, from San Francisco. So now we have three modes of intervention. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Reed.
Hi. I'd like to ask, a couple of years ago, I've been active in the gay movement for many years, but a couple of years ago, I suddenly realized there was the term cisgendered was being used, and I actually didn't know what it meant, and I'm still, other than the fact that it seems to refer to people whose sexuality is consistent, whose gender is consistent with their physical sexuality, unless it means that, how did it come to be? How did this term come into being?
That's a great question. The word trans, the prefix, means like to move across.
Mm-hmm.
And the word cis, C-I-S, it actually is another Latinate prefix that means on the same side as. And where it's been used mostly is in organic chemistry. You have trans molecules and cis molecules. And there were people in the trans activist community who were trying to come up with a word for non-transgender person. They're like, trans people, and what do you call people who are not trans people? Do you call them not trans people? And so right. they proposed the word cisgender, and it stuck. And so, yeah, it's like it's somebody who stays the sex they were assigned at birth and continues to identify
with
it.
But see, Susan, thanks for the call, Reed. That's a really good and important question, and I'm glad you've been involved in gay rights movements, and you were puzzled by
you're
this.
You're still confused.
What
That's
do you
great.
Think of my, you know, conservative parents, you know, mm-hmm. kind of thing. But what you just said, it goes back to something: the basis of people's resistance. For a long time, what you called cisgender is just something unmarked.
Right.
This revolution wants to take what is unmarked and mark it.
Exactly.
And people are like, wait a minute, I'm the unmarked case. And the marked case is the thing that needs explaining, needs, you know, it's the exception, it's a blah, blah, blah. And suddenly you're making me marked rather than unmarked. Where do you get off doing that, people are going to ask you.
Well, you know, I would very politely say, well, it's like, yeah, it's like I'm naming the unmarked position that you've never had to pay any attention to and say that it actually makes a difference.
Right. But that's a complex social. I mean, you're a historian, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so that's a complex social dynamic by which the previously marked gets the demand of the previously unmarked that you get marked to.
Exactly.
Well, thanks for clearing that up.
Well, it's like if you said woman and you only meant white women, and you said, you know, so, you know, all women, like including black women, it's like, right. So that you're marking the minoritized mm-hmm. position. And so why do you use the adjectives only when you're talking about
but
the minority?
But getting to be the unmarked case, mm-hmm. that's not a small thing. Being the unmarked case is not a small thing. I mean, we had a guest once who said
correct.
There's no such thing as white privilege. And we argued about that. And she said, well, we should talk about black rights rather than white privilege. And she had an important point. And I actually love her book, and she's a great thinker. But I do think there is this thing of who gets to be unmarked, right? And that's a constant social struggle over who gets to be unmarked.
So am I a cis philosopher? In other words,
I don't know, is your philosophy cis?
You can be a philosopher or a continental philosopher or a philosopher, you know, an ancient philosopher, but I'm just a philosopher. No, you're a cis philosopher. I guess I could live with that.
So do you think there is, so you said the term cisgendered stuck, and it did stick in certain social, mm-hmm. certain circles. I mean, in the academy and on the left. Do you think you'll ever get Donald Trump to say, and his followers to say,
that they're cisgender
yeah,
people?
Yeah.
maybe all of them except Caitlyn Jenner.
yeah.
No, you know, it's hard to say. It's like, it is not a word that I tended to use, I'll just say. But I see younger people, younger than me, taking it up very readily. I very much see it as part of like college student
right.
discourse, and I see it appearing in print. You know, like it has moved into
right.
Common usage at a rate that surprised me.
Yeah, it surprises me too. But I do think there's a still social dynamic, because I think there's an underground, because you guys were wondering about what the resistance is, mm-hmm. right? And I think the resistance. Resistance is, I think one source of the resistance, we described it as losing something, mm-hmm. and I think a more general abstract characterization is losing your status as unmarked. And I'm not sure that is widely accepted. You know what I mean? I think that's what part of this bathroom debate, which mm-hmm. seems in some ways silly to me for the reasons that John said.
Well, but you can see it in this, you know, this whole Breitbart stuff. They want to go back and just say, well, American, that means white European American. Everything else is kind of deviant. I mean, so it's the idea of being the unmarked, I think, is very deep in conservative culture.
So, Susan, I'm going to tell you, you have one last closing thought, and then we have to say goodbye here.
I'll just say I think you really hit the nail on the head with the idea about the marked versus the unmarked, and that trans people and queer people are not necessarily looking for special rights and privileges, but they are invested in calling out the unmarked privileges that other people have around gender normativity and heterosexuality, and that there is a social vision of a different kind of society and culture in which those differences exist, can be celebrated, but they do not become the basis of oppression.
So on that note, I mean, thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Our guest has been Susan Stryker. She's a professor of gender and women's studies at the University of Arizona, editor of TSQ, Transgender Studies Quarterly. So, John, you got one last closing thought really quickly.
Well, my thoughts have gone back to the 80s when my wife and I were resident fellows at Stanford and sponsored panels a couple every year. Always gays and lesbians. That was the focus then. And it's amazing to see how things have grown more complicated, but more fair and just.
Yeah, so gays and lesbians are losing their status as the unmarked case of the queers.
The unmarked case of the marked case. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So it's a complicated social world we live in. You know, but that's why we do philosophy. And this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website and clicking a few buttons. That's at philosophytalk.org.
Now, there's only one norm this guy carries about, and it's speed. Let's hear from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, been reading a biography of the Benson clan in Victorian and Edwardian England. Dad wound up being the Archbishop of Canterbury, the head of the Anglican Church, who started courting his wife, also his cousin, when he was 23 and she was just 12. Waited until she was legal age before he wed her, and she then embarked on a series of lesbian relationships, including one with the daughter of the previous archbishop, all apparently with the full knowledge of her husband, a stern and moral man in other respects. Along the way, she gave the archbishop 6 children. 4 surviving, 3 of them boys, all of them who grew up to be gay, or at least, as Herman Melville said of Mr. Claggett, a nut not to be cracked by the tap of a lady's fan. So far as is known, none of the Benson boys acted upon their homosexual urges, but you couldn't really say they were repressed. They were very active in society, well-respected, magnetic, prolific. Arthur wrote a 2-volume, 1,000-page biography of his father. Fred gave us the Map and Lucia stories, and some excellent ghost stories as well, and Hugh became a Catholic of note, also an author. Sister Margaret became an Egyptologist, as one did. Celibate gayish men were everywhere in the culture back then. Lewis Carroll, M.R. James, the great ghost story writer, the creepy J.M. Barrie, not to mention the ladies. Bisexual Daphne du Maurier, Virginia Woolf. Back in those days, so I've read, men could have as much sex with each other as they wanted, without fear or censure, so long as they were discreet and outwardly manly. Sexual relations between women were tolerated because it was considered good practice for marriage, and probably kept them sane if they were looking for pleasure from men. They were all too busy being busy Victorians, or gay, or both. And of course, this was in the beginning days of the love that dare not speak its name. A taste, a proclivity, an urge was slowly being recognized as not a disease, not a syndrome, not a condition, but a thing, like being left-handed or freckled, kind of. And yet gayness was fraught with its own history of shadows and hiding and pretending and whispering and codes and furtive glances and bold looks, denial, lust, the whole kit and caboodle. Reticence was part of the seduction game. Is he or isn't he? Should I and why not? Who's watching? Does it matter? Which, after a generation almost now of liberation, led to Milo Yiannopoulos, the now disgraced social gadfly who was so out, he emerged on the other side. mocking trans people, embracing libertarianism as a new freedom, damn the consequences. The love that once dared not speak its name showed us the limits of free speech as Milo got a little too chatty. Overshared with a little too much information. He was dancing the culture dance, but first the left shut him down because he was mean to women of color. Women shut him down because he fronted the obscenely misogynistic Gamergate scandal. The right pretended to like him because he was sassy and not PC, and the right wing loves them, some sassy queens. But when he confessed on cable TV, and inevitably on the internet, to enjoying a very intimate moment with a priest when he was but 14, well, that was a bridge too far even for these stupid endless culture wars. The powers that be had apparently not read Plato's Symposium. And that was that for that cultural phenomenon. Bye-bye, Nelly. See you, Milo. Or as the young people say, bye, Felicia. And queerness marches on. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2017.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
Our senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Audrey Dilling, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Think of it this way. David Evans woke up one day and said, "Everyone call me The Edge." And we all went, "Find the edge? Are we talking the noun or the verb?"
Hey, you made it to the end of the show. Not everybody does.
That means you must really like us. So help us. How can you help us?
Go to philosophytalk.org, look for the I Will Help button, click it, and get ready to help.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you so much for donating.